In an ever-changing world, Off Hollywood Media presents a voice of truth and inspiration, resonating a vibration of love and understanding, illuminating new paths for new directions, as we, as one, strive for higher and higher levels of consciousness, always remembering life changes. And now, your host, our MC, our master of change, Filippo Voltaggio.
Well, ciao everyone. Here we are, another edition of Life Changes, and I'm so excited to be hosting this show today because we're talking about a lot of great things. One of them is love and healing, and this is such an important topic. We have a doctor with us today who's a board-certified doctor, Dr. David Simon, who is going to talk to us about healing and about love and the mind-body connection, which is not necessarily talked about by many doctors and definitely not within the hospital system and the normal traditional medical system. So this is really exciting because technically this could be breakthrough material that has actually been around for a while, and thanks to Dr. Simon, it's getting more and more out there, and we'll talk about it so we can have some breakthroughs in our own lives and change some of the patterns and create more healing in our bodies, in our lives, through love. So I'm looking forward to that. And it's interesting because the talk today that I was going to share at the beginning of the show is a little bit about love, maybe even more about connecting, not just connecting with oneself, but connecting with other people. And it's interesting to me that in my lifetime, in my short lifetime, how communication has changed so much. I remember within my lifetime, my parents saying to us children, they were going to go talk to their friend. They were going to go talk to them. So in those days, it either meant walking to their house or driving to their house. My parents didn't have a car. I'm not that old. Taking the horse and buggy to their house. No, when they finally got a car, they used to drive to their friend's house, or their friends and business associates or what have you, colleagues, used to drive over, come over to have a talk. And that's how communication was had. Talking face to face, looking into each other's eyes, seeing the hand motions and the facial expressions and all of that going on. And then I remember my family got a phone. Now, phones were around. My family just didn't have one. My parents had just come from Italy, and so they didn't have a lot of money. And they also weren't sure about all of these quote-unquote modern things. So they got a phone, and my mom thought that was the strangest thing, and she didn't want one. But my father convinced her that if he were at work and something happened to the kids, she could get a hold of him very quickly. So she thought, okay, we could use it for that. But I'm not going to talk to my friends on a phone. That's so impersonal. There's no connection there. You see what I'm getting at? And at the same time, within this period, people, including myself as a child, used to write letters, and we used to write them by hand. So our connection of using an actual tool and our hands connecting to our minds and actually putting something down and using our own calligraphy and all of that, there's so much going on when you're writing a letter. So these long letters used to be written, and people used to talk in person, and then with a phone, we start talking over the phone, and we have to assume somebody is making some kind of an expression or laughing. We could usually hear, but sometimes if somebody were crying, they might not be so loud about it, and you'd say, are you still there? And you have to guess what's going on the other side of the phone during a phone conversation. Well, it's interesting. We went from that to then we finally got an answering machine. And boy, did people fight answering machines. What are you going to say on a machine? You want to talk to the person. You want to talk to them on the phone, not leave them a message. So people started awkwardly leaving messages, or it's me calling. And before long, we started being able to do business. Like within a short 3-minute message, we could get some sort of business done, like, I'm going to be over your house so we could talk, kind of thing, or call me later so we could talk. But little by little, those messages actually became the talking. Oh, I called my friend today and told her, blah, blah, blah. That was the talking. It was completed. And the other person on the other line had to assume what expressions were used, if any, what was really meant, and read between the lines, so to speak. So all of that to say, then we got typing of the emails. And these emails, these letters that used to be formal and that used to be precise, and we used to write them by hand, and if they weren't correct, we'd start over. Now all of a sudden, we type them out, we send them out whether they have mistakes or not, and this has become our talking. Our communication is these emails. Very little business was being done up recently without emails anymore at taking over the actual engagement of the business. Send me an email on that. No, I don't want to hear you tell me. Write it down in an email. So there's no expression. There's no hand movements. There's no emotion except what's written on the page. And we either have to interpret what's there or not. Maybe we don't care. Maybe we really don't care, because from the emails that got shorter and shorter, and email that could be sent to everybody on your list, and some we don't even read anymore. Oh, Mary wrote me today. I don't even know what she read. It was just one of those blanket things. But I heard from her. Here is something that's being sent to all her friends. That's some chain email. But I heard from Mary today. And now we're texting each other and we're tweeting each other in short, short messages that are written, that are sometimes even misspelled, because some of us have spell check on our iPhones or whatever it may be, and the spelling gets fixed and gets sent when that wasn't the word we were actually wanting to write, and now we have to leave it up to the person on the other end to interpret what we really meant by this incorrect spelling on this short, short email. And it's interesting. One of two things is either happening. Either we've completely lost communication with each other, or we're actually gaining an ability to communicate with each other on another level. Because how could you interpret from something written on Facebook that's four lines, or a smiley face or a sad face, that Joe's not feeling well today, or Steven's in a bad mood, or Alice is happy, in just a few words or lines? Sure, sometimes we make a mistake, but sometimes we're right on. And I'm thinking, I'm on this fence about this. I like the communication in person. As a matter of fact, as I'm speaking with you all, I'm using my hands so much, I can't wait till we're on TV so you can see this happening. Here, there I go again. Till we're on TV. Not till we're face-to-face. Till we're on TV. More impersonal than face-to-face. But on the other hand, I'm noticing that I'm having to guess what my friends are really wanting to say. And you know, 9 times out of 10, I think we're right. And sometimes disputes do happen, and that's sad, because of a mixed up letter in a text, or a text that couldn't go long enough to explain what one was really trying to say. So I won't give a conclusion as to which I think is better, as to whether we are actually in starting to read each other's minds, or whether we have just chosen not to really communicate and sending a text is enough. That's probably conversation for another time. But I wanted to put that out there. I wanted to get that started. And now I want to remind everybody that you're listening to Life Changes, and this is Filippo Voltaggio, your host for this evening, and my pleasure to bring on our guest for this evening, Dr. David Simon. Now, Dr. David Simon is an MD and is a world-renowned authority in the field of mind-body medicine. As a practicing physician, this is where it gets really interesting, an innovative researcher and an insightful teacher, David continues to expand his vision for an effective and compassionate healthcare system. Integrating Ancient Wisdom, Healing Traditions with Modern Scientific Principles, David has forged a model of health that integrates the multiple dimensions of a human being: environmental, physical, emotional, psychological, and spiritual. As a board-certified neurologist and expert in Ayurvedic medicine and other traditional healing arts, he brings a unique perspective to the relationship between mind, emotions, and health. And he is the author of Free to Love, Free to Heal, Heal Your Body by Healing Your Emotions. Thank you, Dr. David Simon, for being on our show.
My pleasure to be here with you.
So you heard about this disconnect that is happening in communications. Do you think this has anything to do with our body being ill?
I actually think that the technology is part of the healing process.
Wow.
You know, one of the first studies I read when I was an anthropology student was called Voodoo Death. It was written by this guy, Walter Cannon, and he described the first account, really, of the fight-or-flight response, where in certain pre-civilized societies, if somebody broke a law or broke a taboo, the shaman, the witch doctor, would come out and point a stick at that person, and they were basically declared persona non grata, so that family members, friends, other members of the community would stop recognizing this person's existence. And he tracked these people and found that most of them would die within a week or two of cardiovascular collapse, that the sense of being completely cut off from social interaction, from family, friends, and community, was so stressful that their blood pressure plummeted, that they got dehydrated, that they literally died of fright, of alienation, of separation.
Wow.
And I think that at some deep level, the essence of healing is that return of connection. And so since, you know, we are tending to be in these nuclear silos more and more, people in small families or living by themselves or in little cubbyholes in their place of work, I actually think that this desire to just touch somebody and to hear them say, I heard you, is part of this deep underlying desire for the fragmented whole to come back together as unity.
That is fascinating. I like that. And so how does that affect the body? Now you're saying, because somebody felt alienated, did they cause themselves to get sick, what happens?
You know, one of my friends, Diane Connolly, once wrote a book called All Sickness is Homesickness, and I think there's tremendous, profound truth in it. In fact, I actually think my earliest experience in mind-body medicine happened when I was about 10 years old and was sent away to a summer camp for a few weeks, and I absolutely hated it. I missed my family. I didn't like the fact that I had to get up at 6 o'clock in the morning. After being there for a few nights, I actually made the decision that the next day I was going to fake a stomach ache so that my parents would have to pick me up. And when I woke up the next morning, to my astonishment, but in some ways to my satisfaction, I had 103 temperature. I had severe tonsillitis, and my parents had to come and pick me up. And I was thinking to myself, this is so cool. I actually was able to make myself sick, which stimulated the activity that would bring me back home. And so on a lot of levels, it's my experience, you know, I've been practicing medicine for almost four decades now. It's my experience that underlying almost every symptom, almost every, not every, but almost every symptom, be it a primarily psychological problem like insomnia or anxiety or depression, or a more physical problem ranging from things like irritable bowel syndrome or chronic headaches or even cancer, that there's almost always a story that underlies that symptom, and that story is almost always a love story, and that love story is almost always a sad love story, a story about alienation, separation, grief, loss, betrayal, disappointment. And so it's my experience that if we can provide the safety for a person to begin to identify and reveal that story, this is the first step of true and authentic healing.
See, now, David, now you're reading my mind, because I was thinking, you know, that great story you told us at the beginning about the shaman shaking a stick at somebody and saying that person is to be an outcast. It happens every day to us and to those we love in the form of, for example, divorce, because when someone gets divorced, sometimes they lose all their friends that are associated with that marriage, and all of a sudden they feel alienated. Or when a loved one dies, especially if it's a parent and someone they relied on, or when somebody loses a job, and all their friends and the people they used to spend 14 hours a day with sometimes, now they're alienated from all of that. Does that cause sickness?
Absolutely. In fact, there was a study published in one of the medical journals a couple of years ago where they tracked 100 people admitted to the hospital, and just ask the question, how many of these conditions could be traced back to some type of mind-body emotional challenge? And it turned out to be a phenomenally high number, like over 80% if you looked at it in a very broad way. So I remember one of the case histories that they reported, which was interesting, of an elderly woman who came in with a hip fracture. So normally we wouldn't think that a hip fracture is a mind-body problem, but in this particular lady's case, the story was that about 3 months ago, her husband of whatever, 45, 50 years, had passed away. And for the first time in decades, she was sleeping by herself. And she couldn't sleep. So in addition to the sleeping medication that her family doctor gave her, she was getting into the habit of drinking a few glasses of sherry every night. And one of these nights, she got up to go to the bathroom, tripped over the rug, fell and broke her hip. So if we just pin her hip, but don't really address that sense of alienation from her community, if we don't bring social support in and try to figure out how we could re-engage this lady, we're treating the symptom, but we're not really looking at the underlying cause. And I think this is really one of the major lacks of our current medical system, is that we're not thinking ecologically. And if we start to realize that human beings are multidimensional, that we have not just molecules that form bodies, but we have minds, and we have hearts, and we have souls, and we have relationships, that if we really looked at it the way that healers have looked at it for millennia, then we can really affect healing and probably solve a lot of the major problems that our healthcare system is facing these days.
It just seems so backwards, what's being described here, with what we've learned within the medical field of how we need to treat the problems that are going on in our bodies. Something happens, we go to the doctor, and you're saying all they're really fixing is the symptom, they're not fixing the problem, and this is what we've been doing for all this time.
You know, and sometimes fixing the symptom is still amazingly beneficial. You know, when we discovered penicillin in the early 1900s, for a brief while, we had this idea that there was a pill for every problem. You know, there was a silver bullet. And so most of scientific research over the last 100 years has really been about trying to find these targeted therapies. And, of course, if they work, you know, all of us would embrace them. The problem is that most of the time, the medicines that we employ may temporarily relieve a symptom, but really don't go to the underlying cause. You know, in one of the ancient healing systems known as Ayurveda, it comes from India, it's about 5,000 years old, there's actually a chapter in one of the textbooks on the definition of a quack. And according to this ancient healing system, a quack is a doctor who treats the symptoms of a disease without looking to the origins of an illness.
Wow.
So in a lot of ways, you know, when we see someone with heartburn and we give them a proton pump inhibitor, or we see someone with high blood pressure and we give them an angiotensin converting enzyme inhibitor, or we see someone with depression and we give them a selective serotonin reuptake inhibitor, we may temporarily influence the symptom, but it's not part of the usual training of medical doctors to say, you know, what's causing the heartburn, what's causing the insomnia, what's causing the depression. And, you know, it's my experience that we're really not serving our patients and our community if we don't ask these questions and don't see if we can affect a deeper level of healing and balance.
What I'm getting from you, David, is that there is a you have a beautiful way of describing this, and you're not pointing fingers. Instead, what I'm feeling is that you feel that there is a way to have harmony within the two ways of healing. And what I'm getting is that perhaps somebody has some kind of an issue, like let's say a major headache and they can't think, that you might be able to give them something to relieve the headache in the moment, and then you can more easily address what the problem is, as opposed to just relieving the headache and then sending them on their way as if they were cured.
Right. So, you know, we just heard an ambulance go by, so presumably
exactly.
at that point someone is being injured or having a heart attack, and that's not the time to talk about are you getting along in your marriage or do you really like your job. It's the time to, you know, provide the most effective medical intervention that's going to keep this person breathing and their heart beating. But then you can step back and say, what's leading to these conditions? And you know, we know more than ever how important lifestyle, emotions, perspective, point of view, past experiences are on our health. You know, there was just a really interesting study published in one of the major medical journals known as Psychosomatics, and they looked at people who were admitted to hospital with an autoimmune disease. So I think most listeners know that an autoimmune disease is a disease where the immune system becomes confused, and instead of the immune cells doing their job of fighting off infection or fighting cancer, they turn against our own body, and they create havoc. You know, they're the basis of diseases like rheumatoid arthritis, which affects the joints, or multiple sclerosis, which affects the brain, or ulcerative colitis, which affects the digestive system. And these are common conditions. Well, in this study, they looked at 500 people who were admitted to the hospital with one of these conditions, and they compared them to about 5,000 people who did not. And they looked at what were their childhoods like. And in this study, they identified what they called 7 adverse childhood experiences. So the 7 were being subjected to emotional abuse as a child, being subjected to physical abuse as a child, being subjected to sexual abuse as a child, having a lot of violence in the household between your caregivers, having someone in the household with a drug addiction or alcoholism, having someone in the household with mental illness, and the 7th was going through a very tumultuous divorce, being the child where your parents went through a really conflict-laden divorce. And what they found in this study is that for every one of these adverse childhood experiences, which, of course, at least one of them affects, you know, a high percentage of the population, you had a 20% increased risk of developing an autoimmune disease decades later in adulthood, that this residue of these toxic emotional experiences really stay with us and ultimately become cellular and can influence our health or our illness. And so, you know, it's another piece of evidence that our thoughts and our feelings directly translate into our physiology, and that if we can help people heal their thoughts and their feelings, we can avoid many of the conditions that really plague our society. This is from heart disease to cancer, from chronic fatigue to obesity. You know, all of these conditions have an emotional component. Sometimes the emotional component is primary, sometimes it's secondary, but there's almost always some role for helping people heal and transform their emotions and really create more love in their life.
You know, Doctor, I want to get into that a little bit more, but before we do, you reminded me of something about childhood that I noted that being around many young ladies growing up, I remember how the young ladies with straight hair used to complain that they had straight hair and they would curl it or perm it and ruin their hair in so doing sometimes. And the ones with curly hair used to complain because their hair was curly and they would straighten it and iron it and ruin their hair in the process and have all that frustration. And going through your book, I found the physical characteristics of what's wrong with us. And you had I'm too fat, I'm too thin, I'm too short, I'm too tall, I'm too dark, I'm too pale, my hair is too curly, my hair is too kinky, my hair is too straight, whatever, right?
You know, childhood is not that idyllic time that we like to remember. Childhood is extraordinarily competitive. Most kids never quite get enough attention or love. And so in order to make an individual feel better, they find something about the other person to something that's a little different than the normal, and then they focus on it and create insecurity. So, you know, for most of us, we didn't have that idyllic childhood. We weren't raised by enlightened parents. And those sibling rivalries and those school challenges, you know, can leave their mark unless there's a healthy family dynamic that really helps us process it and clear it and maintain that healthy self-esteem. But, you know, it's not that easy being human.
Actually, yes. You somewhere in your book, I think it's towards the beginning, you said something about being human. Well, what was it that you said that just struck me? Growing up human. Yes. What do you mean, growing up human? Is that what you're talking about? It's not easy?
Yeah, well, I mean, part of the reason it's not easy is that most of us were raised by children. You know, it's fairly recently that women were waiting even until their 30s to have kids. You know, most of us, our moms were having us by the time they were in their late teens or early 20s. And, you know, emotionally, there's not enough development there. It's funny, actually, I have some young daughters at home, and recently a girl in my 12-year-old's class, in her 6th grade class, got her period. She's the first girl to get her period. She's only 11. And I was kind of startled, thinking that this 11-year-old girl is now physiologically, biologically capable of having a baby. But clearly, emotionally, you know, she's decades away from that. And so the problem is most of us were raised by amateurs. Most of us were not consciously taught about how to identify and communicate our core needs. Most of us learned a kind of rules of engagement that were at least partially, if not totally, dysfunctional. And therefore, you know, it took a lot of us a while to figure it out, but the residue of that, depending upon how painful that was, can have an effect not only on our psychological but on our physical health.
Wow. And that's all of what you're saying here. And we're not addressing that under normal circumstances. So how do we address that? Say somebody comes, well, does somebody come to you, or are you suggesting, what do we do? We're not feeling well. What's the first thing we do?
The first thing we do is we ask our bodies. You know, when our bodies are generating a symptom, be it heartburn or headache or a lump in the breast, you know, the first thing we can ask is, what are you trying to tell me? And in my experience, bodies are like children. They're not terribly sophisticated, but they have clear-cut needs. You know, if you have a child and it wants your attention and you're too busy working on the computer, the child will come back several times and eventually will stop asking for your attention, but then you'll realize that the kid has taken all the dishes out of the cabinet or taken all the medicine out of the cabinet. And the body is like that. The body will generate symptoms in an effort to get some needs met. And if we ignore those symptoms, the body will often escalate until it's literally throwing a tantrum and demands us to listen to what's going on. So, you know, a first step for everyone, particularly someone who's struggling with some kind of chronic health challenge, is to close their eyes, sit quietly, quiet down their mind, and simply scan your body and see where in your body are you carrying some tension, some strain, some stress, some pain, and just have a conversation. What are you trying to tell me? And my experience is that if you create the context by quieting down the mind and really paying the attention, more often than not, your body has some powerful information for you about your life. You're taking on too much, you're holding yourself back from something, there's a relationship that's not really nurturing you, you're not in a job that you like, you're substituting healthy, nourishing interactions with, you know, alcohol or drugs or something else. And the first step is really to just listen and hear the message. And then the next step is to start asking, you know, what can I do to more directly meet those needs rather than using what most people use, which are kind of distracted, secondary, less effective ways to get those needs met. And, you know, if there's a long history of unmet needs, then often people carry that emotional toxicity with them. And then, you know, the book that I wrote, the most recent book, Free to Love, is really, in a sense, an emotional detoxification process. You know, again, studied this system, Ayurveda, for decades now, and Ayurveda has some interesting concepts which I think can serve as metaphors for these emotional issues. One of the most important principles in Ayurveda is this concept known as Agni, which in its most direct translation means fire. Agni means fire. We can remember it because it's the origins of the word ignite or ignition. And the principle says that we have this inner fire, which basically is designed to cook our experiences. And if the Agni is burning brightly, if the inner digestive fire is burning brightly, then we're able to extract the components of our experiences which are nurturing, nourishing, and eliminate those which are toxic. But if the experience overwhelms the digestive fire, then we're left with the residue of that experience, and that residue, that toxic residue, begins to interfere with our psychological or physical health. So, you know, on a purely physical level, if someone's been eating too much saturated fat or cholesterol in their diet, their body may not be able to fully metabolize that, and that saturated fat gets deposited into their blood vessels, and over time it can lead to a heart attack or stroke. So that's an example of physical toxicity. On a financial level, what we're seeing in our whole world right now is what we could call financial toxicity, which is basically people bought off more materialism than they could digest by taking out too much debt on their credit cards or buying houses that their mortgages were too big. And so that undigested residue of all this material consumption, you know, has basically stagnated the economy. You know, we even talk about them as toxic assets. But in my experience as a physician, the most important toxicity is emotional toxicity, that experiences that overwhelmed our digestive capacity, either as a child or as an adult, where we were disappointed or abused or neglected or didn't get our needs met. And people carry this with them, and it, in their hearts, it begins to interfere with their ability to be open and present and enthusiastic and loving. And over time, it can make us not only psychologically unwell, but really physically sick.
Wow. I'd like to remind everybody that we're listening to Dr. David Simon, and that you all are listening to Life Changes, and I'm your host, Filippo Voltaggio, and you can learn more about Dr. David Simon, obviously, in his book, and learn about what he's sharing with us today. The book is Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions, and you can find out about that at our website at lifechanges.ws, or directly at his website for the Chopra Center, chopra.com, which is chopra.com. And Doctor, you started this whole conversation about what we need to do with listen to our body was your answer. Now, at the Chopra Center, I imagine this is something that you help patients do, but you, I'm sure, know that most of us are not raised to listen to our bodies. So what does actually listening to our bodies mean? Do we actually hear a voice? And I ask this question, too, because when I started listening, I used to think that the answers that were coming were just things that I wanted to hear or things that I was forcing upon my mind, but it actually was my body. So elaborate on that, please.
Well, first of all, what you said about we weren't taught that is so true. I mean, it goes back so early that, you know, you're going to first grade, you know, and you have to be in class at 7:30, and you're definitely not hungry, but
right.
You're taught you have to eat breakfast because your mom knows that when you do get hungry at 9 o'clock, she's not going to be there. So immediately you're taught, don't listen to your body. You know, then you're taught, then where most of us were taught, we have to finish everything on our plate because children are starving somewhere else.
Right.
And we're taught to disregard those signals of comfort or discomfort, satiety or hunger. And so, you know, the whole messages that we get so early on, which are really designed to condition us to function in society, are often, you know, opposed to our nature. So, you know, as anyone who's responsible for raising kids should, you know, be aware of this and encourage as much as possible children to at least start listening to what their bodies are telling them. But, you know, the body is pretty simple. It either generates signals of comfort or discomfort. Those are the core feelings that the body generates. One of my favorite novelists is Tom Robbins, who in one of his novels wrote, there's really only two mantras in life. There's yum and there's yuck. And those are really the mantras of the body. And so, you know, when you quiet down and you listen to your body is saying, hey, I'm happy, I'm healthy, I have a lot of vitality, I'm sleeping soundly, my digestion is good, I'm eliminating, I have a lot of enthusiasm for my life, that's pretty good evidence that you're making good choices. If, on the other hand, your body is saying, hey, I'm having trouble sleeping, or I'm waking up repeatedly throughout the night, I'm eating out of stress rather than out of hunger, I've got digestive disturbances, I'm having trouble eliminating, my vitality is low, I've got pain here or there, then that's your body telling you that either there's something that you're carrying with you from your past that's no longer serving you, or there's something that you're holding yourself back from that you know will be nurturing to you. Now, you know, that means we have to be courageous, because society doesn't necessarily want us to take time for ourselves. Society wants us to function and meet our obligations, be they family or work obligations. But if we don't take the time to ask ourselves those core questions, am I carrying with me something from the past that's not serving me in this present moment? Or is there something that I'm really longing for that I've been feeling unworthy of? Then we can start to make those changes. And it doesn't have to be necessarily leaping, you know, off of a building. It doesn't mean if you're in a job that you're not feeling nurtured in that you suddenly have to quit your job and become a musician. But it may mean you start defining an hour a couple times a week to play music. It doesn't mean if you're in a relationship that's not so nurturing that you suddenly leave your spouse and your children. It means either you start having the conversations about what your needs are and how you might be able to get them met, or you at least start trying to find other ways to nurture those needs so that your body will respond. You're looking for your body to respond to changes in behavior through the generation of more comfortable sensations. And if you're really dealing with a condition, with an illness, then it's your body escalating its demands. And it's really important whether or not your doctor is asking these questions or not for you to ask those questions. And certainly at the Chopra Center, we give people the space, the time, the attention, and the safety to really start asking those questions. And the interesting thing is that the answers are quite similar. It almost doesn't matter what your body is complaining about. You know, almost in everyone, the issues are around love. You know, there's some relationship that's not totally nurturing. It's around work. I'm in a job that I feel stuck and I need to do it because I have to pay the mortgage, but I'm really miserable. It's around passion. You know, there's something that I want to do or I sense I should be doing, but I'm not giving myself permission. It's around creativity. And so, you know, we teach people the skill set to start taking those steps that allow people to get more love, to have more passion, to make better choices that are going to allow them to express their creativity. And again, it doesn't have to be all or nothing, just incremental permission to be happier. You know, I think I start off the book by asking, you know, by talking about, I ask almost every patient who's struggling, do you deserve to be happy? And it's amazing how many people aren't really sure that they deserve to live their life in the direction of happiness because they haven't been told that. But if you start to follow your bliss, as Joseph Campbell, the mythologist, told us, then the body responds and the mind responds. In fact, I was just recently, I'll take one second, I was recently meeting with this terrific Jungian psychologist named Robert Johnson. He's the last remaining Jungian therapist who studied with Carl Jung. He's written these terrific books like We, He, She, Ecstasy. He's in his late 80s now. And he said, when I was telling him about this book, Free to Love, he said, oh, Dr. Jung would like this book because Dr. Jung would say, your dream is your prescription, which is amazingly profound. You look inside and say, hey, what's my dream? You know, what's my dream about my life? And if you're not following your dream, your body's going to get sick. And if you say, what is my dream? And you start following your dream, then that's your prescription.
Wow. Well, you know, it's interesting. Talking about your permission and talking about love, one of the biggest things that I really liked about your book is a particular exercise and the love of self that is so important. And in the book, it talks a little bit about how we sometimes think that we're not worthy because we have certain traits, when what you're really trying to say to us in the book is that we are worthy no matter what, and that's where we start. And in this particular exercise, that you stand with a partner, and you say to the partner what trait it is, and in this case, the example you give is, I am a slob. And your partner mirrors back, you can be a slob. And then you repeat, I can be a slob. And the partner mirrors back, you can be a slob. And this is a big and I love you anyway.
Because all of us are the coexistence of opposite values. You know, this is how we formulate our personality. We're taught really early on there are certain characteristics or traits or qualities that are considered desirable, and those are the qualities that we put into our ego. And then there are those qualities or traits or characteristics that we're taught are undesirable, and those are the characteristics that we put into our shadow. They don't go away, they're just hidden from the world. But every one of us can be a slob, right? We may never allow ourselves to be a slob, but every one of us could be a slob. Every one of us could be both courageous and cowardly. Every one of us can be generous and stingy. And the more that we can embrace our duality, we can embrace our light side and our dark side, our ego self and our shadow self, it doesn't make us weak, it makes us whole. And when we're willing to embrace that each of us has both, quote, positive and negative qualities, it makes us much less judgmental when we see those qualities being expressed in other people. And there's so much stress. I mean, every day in the news, you know, why did Tiger do what Tiger did? Because he was struggling so hard to be that perfect person that all that other aspect of his deep natural self was being suppressed until it tended to break out in ways that ultimately caused harm to him and to others. But, you know, every one of us is the coexistence of these opposite values. Every one of us is this agglutination of ambiguities or this conglomeration of contradictions. And the more that we can embrace our duality, the more freedom we have in our own life and the more accepting we are of everybody else's duality. So, you know, we do that exercise in our courses, and at first people are, you know, quite embarrassed to acknowledge it, but when they realize that everybody else has those same qualities that they've been hiding from the world, it just lets us be easier. We don't waste so much time and energy locking up these so-called negative traits in these prisons that keep, and the prisoners keep rattling the cages, sabotaging our best efforts, making us miserable. And, you know, it's interesting because it's very cultural as well. You know, if you're raised in a family where everyone in your family is a construction worker, if you announce, hey, I want to be a musician, I want to play the piano, that quality may be disparaged. And so you would decide that your creative musical side is a negative quality and you'd lock it up in your shadow. Whereas if you're in another family where, you know, the arts and music are prized and you said, hey, what I really want to do is, you know, work on and, you know, become an auto mechanic, then that quality may be disparaged. So we have to give up the idea that there are absolutes, rights, and wrongs here and recognize that life is complicated. And the more we're willing to embrace our own complexities, the more freedom we have and the easier it is to accept the complexities of everyone else.
And I wonder if some of this is by design, because as I shared in the beginning of the show, my parents came from Italy, and I remember them telling us so many beautiful things about Italy, but they couldn't work there, the job wasn't there for them, whatever, and so my dad came here. And so we grew up hearing about beautiful Italy, and all of us couldn't wait to go to Italy, and we talked about moving there. My dad would say, no, you're not. I came all the way over here so you could have a good life. You're not going to go there. And it goes back to the young ladies who had straight hair versus the ones who had curly hair. And still, it's either the grass is always greener or whatever it is. We're doing this to ourselves, and it's causing illness, right?
You know, I think that when God told Adam and Eve to not bite into the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, what he was really saying is, if you get too engaged in this idea of duality, you know, that there's a right and a wrong, a good and evil, then you leave the garden. And you know, Freud once said that neurosis is the inability to tolerate ambivalence. So we're all neurotic because ambivalence is not something that we were taught is acceptable. You know, you're either good or you're bad, you're right or you're wrong. But the truth is that health requires us to tolerate ambiguity and tolerate ambivalence. And when we can go from the conflict of contradiction to the kind of peace of paradox, when we can accept that this is true and its opposite also has truth, then we free up all that energy that is available for creativity, for healing, for transformation, for love, for enthusiasm of life.
You know, Dr. Simon, I know you have some great stories of healing, and this is such out of our norm, unfortunately, and I hope by what you're all doing at the Chopra Center, and of course I know a lot of people that are doing similar work and your book and what you're sharing with us today, that this can become the norm. And I think it would be great if you could leave us with a story of emotional healing, one maybe that has impacted you, but that will certainly impact our audience and help us see what you're trying to relate to us here.
So I'll tell you a story that's uncomfortable to hear, but there's a good outcome. I saw a lady actually a couple months ago who's been chronically ill. She was in her 50s when I saw her, chronically ill with all sorts of what Western medicine called psychosomatic disorders, things like chronic fatigue syndrome and fibromyalgia, and just not a happy lady. And then when she finally got a breast cancer, she decided that she had to deal with some of these deeper unresolved issues. So she came to the Chopra Center, and I spent several sessions with her trying to understand what her story was. And her story was terrible, really one of the, I hear a lot of sad stories, but this was one of the sadder stories, that her father, who was a Vietnam vet, came back and almost immediately began to sexually abuse her, starting at the age of 6, going through the age of 11. Mm. That was terrible enough. But what was really terrible is that at the age of 11, he took her to his auto repair shop. And while she was there, two robbers came into the shop and demanded the combination to the safe. And the father wouldn't give the combination, so they took this little girl, put her on the ground, put a gun to her head, and said, if you don't tell us the combination, we're going to blow her brains out. And the father, who was sexually abusing this daughter, said, go ahead, blow her brains out, I don't care. They didn't. They didn't, but you can't even, you know, who could imagine what that would have done to this woman's self-esteem. And so that translates. You can see how that would translate into just so much distress and illness and ultimately even suppression of her immune system. Wow. But through the process that we worked through, you know, through some pretty intense work, she actually learned something. She learned, having called back to her mother, who she had been estranged from for years because she was almost more angry at her mother for not protecting her than her father, that it turns out her father had had a brain injury in Vietnam. And that after his brain injury, his whole personality had changed, and that was probably why all of his boundaries got so distorted and he got to be such a miserable being. But through this process of understanding, telling the story, having it received without judgment, helping her realize that it wasn't her fault, that she was a beautiful, lovable, worthy being, and doing some strong, powerful rituals of release, she will now tell us that she feels more emotionally liberated than she's ever had. She's fortunately gotten through the breast cancer because it was a fairly localized lesion. But more importantly for her, many of these chronic complaints that she's suffered with for decades have now evaporated. And she's really looking at the next stage of her life as almost a rebirthing. So that's an extreme story, but not that uncommon. And I know, you know, and the sad news, of course, is this poor lady had been to a dozen or more different types of doctors trying to treat the symptom without anyone really creating the safety where she could explore this deeper, very toxic, emotionally-based childhood.
Wow, what a story. You know, Dr. Simon, I have not had the pleasure of meeting you. I know you know that, actually. That's not what I was going to say. But I have met people that know you, and they have said, actually friends of mine have said, that you are the heart and the soul of the Chopra Center. And in talking to you tonight, I could see why that can be the case, because you feel this stuff. I could tell how you believe in this, obviously, and you know it to be true, and you care. And it's coming through in what you're sharing with us. It comes through in your book. And I thank you for being on path and doing what you're doing.
Well, thank you, and thank you for having me on your show. And, you know, I just think that there is an opportunity for our whole society to bring this conversation into more conscious awareness, and it will be good for us, it'll be good for our children, it'll be good for our planet. You know, the more that we recognize our common unity, then the differences that separate us and create conflict will be less important. You know, going back to what we started at the beginning, I think that all this technology is just this call to come back together. And in my worldview, love is that impulse to reconnect from our separateness to our essential unity. And I think this conversation is part of that journey.
And you gave an interesting twist to my whole introduction, which I really appreciated, because I do see that side of it, and I have to agree with you there as well, of people communicating and coming together in community. This has been wonderful, not only for me, but I'm sure for all of our guests, audience listening. We are going to have this up on our website, and I hope that many people get to listen to it and get the book, Free to Love, Free to Heal. Heal your body by healing your emotions. We've had Dr. David Simon on the air here with his book, and he is with the Chopra Center. So to learn more about him, you can go to our website at lifechanges.ws and also at his website, chopra.com, that's chopra.com, and you can also get the book there as well. Dr. David Simon, thank you once again, and I hope to meet you in person soon.
Great. Thanks again to you.
My pleasure. Wow. That says so much to us that we can heal through love, which changes everything, changes the way we look at medicine, the way we look at our hospital systems, and all of that. And I appreciate Dr. Simon for being on with us today. And something that changes how we think every week here is the State of the Universe address, and we have that brought to you by Dorothy Lee.
Hi, I love the show. I love the book. I hope you will all do yourself a favor and get it. It's really great. I'm very excited about the words I'm sharing with you tonight. There is an incredible video on YouTube that is circulating with quotes from the December 2009 issue of the Sedona Journal. And I'm sharing some of these quotes and thoughts with you because they're so awesome. These quotes come from higher dimensional beings, and they contain some predictions for what 2010 will bring to us. And there's great wisdom and advice for us that will help us grow. These are some really great thoughts from higher vibrational beings, and I encourage each of you to ponder on them for a while. First, we would suggest pausing for a moment and recognizing that the great unknown is your paradise. We are only giving you the potential of what you are most inclined to do. We are not giving you some magic futures created by energies that are not yours. The concept of free choice creates a constant and continuously changing track in front of you. In 2010, anything that you desire strongly will manifest before your eyes. There will be a number of people who will increasingly be aware of a longing within themselves for more. Souls will be stirring that have not been awake for many, many lifetimes. In the year 2010, it will be harder to hide truth. Transparency will become the watchword of the times. This coming year is a time to shed the perception of trouble and strife and exchange that vision for one of transformation, growth, sharing, and envisioning the new reality you are striving for. The world is full, fat, and overripe with juicy secrets now. These will seep, pop, and explode onto the world stage this year. 2010 will be the year that conspiracy theorists will say, "I told you so." Much will come to the forefront that was hidden in the past, including such areas as UFOs, psychic phenomena, healing miracles, and government cover-ups. Universal truths about energy and the interconnectedness of all life will emerge into the mainstream with increasing speed. There will be a growing sense of awareness across the planet that many things aren't really as they have appeared to be for a long time. For many of you, this will be the year when you get it. The demystifying of life on the grand scale it is occurring now is unprecedented. The new worldview is being created from the inside out instead of the outside in. Human beings will move from instinctual survival to conscious creation. What happens between now and 2012 will be the foundation for the next 10 years. And what transpires within the next 10 years will be the foundation for the next 100 years and more. Be prepared for the announcement of cures for devastating diseases. Be prepared for some amazing technologies that will support the restoration of the dirtied waterways. Evolutionary medical processes found through stem cell technology will bring the masses to absolute gaping awe. People will be able to live uncompromisingly with strong bones well into their 90s after this year's discoveries. Researchers will begin studying human emotions more thoroughly and will see how humans play a vital role in the creation of sickness, and the scientific communities will slowly start accepting this. In the year 2010, you're going to have a young people's crusade because of the Internet. Technology developed by hackers will permit people of all races and ethnicity to communicate without the interference of governments or countries seeking to silence them. Another blessing of the Internet will be the lifting of the curtains hiding child labor. Communities will once again spring up in a way that has not been seen in a long time. You will begin to see a marked increase in the demand for wholesome, healthy, non-contaminated foods. The past that held gods who took sides is dying. A power circling perpetually throughout this year to help you achieve your dreams, success, and enlightenment is the power of visioning. So if we were to give you advice that were to hold true for the entire year, it would be to become a powerful visionary. Energy follows thought. We see even the last of you emerging from the fog soon. Do not give your precious energy to a dying past. Face the brilliance of your most wonderful creations. And last but not least, here is an important, easy thing for all of us to do. Dwell on your dreams. If you liked what you've heard tonight and would like to share these thoughts, predictions, and wisdom with your loved ones, just go to my website, energeticalchemy.com, and you will find them on the More Thoughts page, listed as Sedona Journal, December 2009. Thank you for listening, and until next week, please remember that you are the power in your world. You are the guru you have been waiting for. Please choose to become a very conscious co-creator by making truly elegant choices, and never forget that you are powerful beyond measure and that you are love, you are lovable, and you are loved.
Thank you, Dorothy Lee, for that State of the Universe address. And that's our show for today. We had Dr. David Simon on, and we thank him for being on our show. We have a guest next week, but I don't have it written down as to who that's going to be. But it's a great guest, I know, because I remember seeing who it was. And remember, you can keep the conversation going during the week by visiting us on our website or visiting us on our Facebook pages and our fan page on Facebook as well. Today's show has been made possible in part by our sponsors, IonWays Water Systems, Change Your Water, Change Your Life, and Love and Miracles. And to learn more about them, visit our sponsor page on our website. I am Filippo Voltaggio, and it has been my pleasure being of service by hosting Life Changes today. I, along with our segment hosts, Dorothy Lee, and producer, and our producer, Mark Legere, and engineer, Seth, thank you for joining us and being part of the show and being part of the change. We all wish...
You have been listening to Life Changes with the Master of Change, Filippo Voltaggio. Join us here every Monday night at 7 p.m. Pacific Standard Time and visit us on the web at lifechanges.ws. Also, you can follow our community on Facebook at Life Changes. Join us here next week as we consciously embrace and explore the only constant, Life Changes.